This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
This is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here in the studio with Carey Jr. II, who is the show's producer. Hey, Carey.
How you doing?
So we want to today continue this look at the U.S. Census and the changes that they've decided to make to add new racial or ethnic categories. One was Latino, Hispanic, and we heard from Maria Hinojosa, the host of Latino USA, about that change.
Incorrect.
Yes, right? She didn't love it. She thought that this was too little, too late, and that it doesn't capture the essence of the Latino presence here in the United States. Today, we're going to talk about the second category change, which is to add Middle Eastern and North African to the census. We're going to talk with Maya Berry, who's the executive director of the Arab American Institute, about what this change means. This change is a little different, I think, than the Latino-Hispanic one in the sense that it covers a much broader part of the world, really, and pulls in many more countries and many more cultures.
I mean,
it'll be interesting to hear what they think this actually means.
It also, I mean, it's been a long effort for them too, multiple decades for the Arab American community, leaders from that community to really create a racial category that included them. So on the one hand, it does seem like this is a productive move, but also it's also a pretty broad category. It's a whole region of folks.
Like, yes.
When we talk about inaccuracy with the Hispanic, I'm curious with the Hispanic Latino category and how Maria sees it, I'm curious to see what Maya Berry has to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you were from the Middle East or North Africa and filling out the census up until now, there was a far less clear way to identify yourself in specificity. A lot of these citizens have been checking white for their race, for instance, for a really long time. Now they won't have to do that. And so I'm really eager to hear what this means and why it matters in practical terms to them, the things that they think may be different in their lives because of this new way to identify themselves.
And because they've been such a strong effort, they wanted this, this community was really pushing for this. We might hear a really more precise explanation on what this might do and how this is valuable for their community. But I want to turn your attention really quickly to Stephen, to this kind of outline they have, the sample of listings for the racial categories that'll be on the census. I'm pulling it from this NPR story. They have it embedded in their story. And at the and if you look down at the Middle Eastern or North African category, this new category, they have the box next to Middle Eastern or North African, and then they have underneath that box a bunch of different categories: Lebanese, Syrian, Iranian, Iraqi, Egyptian, Israeli, and then a box below that if you want to fill it in. What I find funny is that they even have in this font, for example, Moroccan, Yemeni. That should be game-changing going forward.
Yeah, and the question is how much of a game-changer, but also how much more do they think needs to be done to be able to address the issues that this community has?
All right, enough of me talking. Let's hear Maya Berry.
Maya Berry, it's really great to have you here in Detroit and with us on Created Equal. Thanks for joining.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much for having us and for covering this topic.
Sure, sure. So I want to start with the idea of how important this is, this change on the U.S. Census, from your point of view, to folks in the Middle Eastern and North African community. Why do we need a MENA category on the census?
It is exceptionally important. And I was just having a conversation earlier today with a group of colleagues, and it was a discussion about how the race and ethnicity standards were revised and issued. And we kind of came around to, you know, well, is the glass half empty or is the glass half full?
Right.
And I pointed out that for the first time ever, my community has a glass. So
that is a really great way to put that, right? You just got a glass. Now you got to fill it.
Right. That's exactly right. So I think, yeah, I can't overstate the significance of finally getting to the point of having a minimum reporting category that will appear on the decennial census and all federal data collection forms. So that's the other point of this. This is bigger than just the census. Although the census is pretty darn big. Mm-hmm. So it's incredibly significant, and it's been decades in the making. And it's important to understand that there really is almost nothing that is not directly impacted by the federal statistical standards in terms of the way that they present information about communities, the way that the U.S. Federal government uses that data. So it's big. It's very big. And the only other point I would make is that I think as we talk about these issues, and I so appreciate the opportunity to be with you today to do that, is to kind of understand that the category itself, mm-hmm. MENA, is Middle Eastern North African. And it is, I always like to emphasize that it is a broad and diverse geographical,
yes,
and racially diverse category. So it's actually communities plural.
Yes, right.
That's it's hard great. To parse the language, but I think it's important to note that.
Right. It's not one community. Mm-hmm. And I do want to get back to the question of the impact and the specifics of how that matters. But let's stop on the point that you're making right now, which is that this is a very broad and diverse descriptor. Talk about how broad and diverse that is. Who would logically be among the people who would select a category like this on the census?
What an incredibly important question. And I would tell you that I'm going to answer it based on what we believe it should be answered. And uh-huh. It's not clear yet that is where the standards landed or that how the Census Bureau will operate.
Okay.
But the Middle East North Africa is a broad geographical category, would include the 22 members of the Arab League, so the Arab states, mm-hmm. that are identified as Arab. It would also include non-Arab MENA, which would be Iran, Israel, Turkey. So these are countries within the Middle East and North Africa that are non-Arab. And then in addition to that, the Middle East has transnational communities. And this is a particularly important piece for Michigan, mm-hmm. where we have the highest concentration of Chaldeans and Assyrians who are part of the Middle East and North Africa, but may not necessarily identify under an Arab umbrella. So they're transnational communities that are here in the U.S. The Armenian Americans are another example of that. Kurds are another example of that.
Wow.
So it's a pretty broad category with those main three areas. And then within that, we have to understand that as an ethnicity, Arab Americans and even MENA populations can identify with any of the racial categories. It's an ethnic category, very much like Latinos.
Mm-hmm. And when you think of the significance to this community of this glass that you have now been handed to fill, I mean, I think that's a separate question, really, from what the practical implications are. And I guess one way to think of it is by asking, what have folks who have been filling out the census up until now, who would describe themselves as being of the backgrounds that you just talked about, what were they doing? What were they missing in the way that they were forced to fill it out before?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to answer it specifically with regards to Arab Americans, because that's the work that, you know, and it's important to understand that Arab Americans are the single largest segment
of
the MENA population. What we were missing is pretty much everything. you would look at a federal form. You would look at your local schools form. You would look at any time it came out an opportunity to check a box. You would look and say, "Okay, I don't see myself here. How do I check this? Fill this out?" Mm-hmm. And I give this as an example. I tell this story. I have personally never checked any existing boxes. I've always checked other, and then within that, I've written in Arab Americans.
Okay.
Now, others may identify differently, but that's how I've done it. So in my local school districts, I have two kids. One of them, we would fill out their forms, check out other. One of them was coded as white, and the other one was coded as Asian. Huh. So I have two kids, and in my local school districts, they were two different racial categories. That only happens because there was no accurate way in which to gather the information about my kids in my local school district.
I see.
And you can literally take that small little example and apply it to so many other areas, from hate crime data collection to civil rights protections to EOC complaints to the way congressional districts are drawn to voting rights. There's nothing that isn't directly impacted by the ability to have accurate data on these communities. And if no checkbox, no category existed, we lingered in this space where we were rendered completely invisible within the data.
Yeah. And that gets us to these practical implications that you were kind of referring to before, the things that will be different because of data that's collected by the census. But as you point out, it's all federal data that will be collected with this new descriptor, and that it reaches really deeply into people's lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In addition to the fact, as you said, all federal agencies will adopt these new standards. Once the federal government has laid down this groundwork, you will see that states will begin adopting the federal standards. You will see that universities who are going to conduct research, as they do, will adopt the federal standards. It's an extraordinary breakthrough moment that we're going to see have very meaningful and improvements to people's lives. And I do think it's the reason this battle has been taking place. I shouldn't refer to it as a battle. It's the reason this effort has been underway since the founding of my organization in 1985. The first partnership we put in place with the Census Bureau was in 1990. And the first time we specifically sought to create a new category was in 1995, right before the last time the race and ethnicity standards were revised in 1997.
Yeah.
So it's been a long haul because it's one of those issues that is so directly impactful to people's lives.
Right. You described it as a battle before backing away from that language. I'm going to push you back, though, to that word, because it does seem to me like this was a battle, and it's a battle that has gone on a long time, as you point out. Tell us about why this has taken so long and what the efforts looked like to bring or drag perhaps federal officials to the point where they were willing to do it.
I so appreciate your reframe on that. And let me explain why, because I do think that's an incredibly thoughtful way to kind of think about it. I walk back the battle because at every step of the way, the Census Bureau has really understood the need to collect more accurate data about this community and has acknowledged the massive undercount that has been there. Mm-hmm. So when we made the ask back in 1995 and said we need a new category, the Office of Management and Budget, when it released those new standards, said, "We heard you. There were a lot of comments submitted that you wanted this, but we need more testing." And that was highly regrettable because we went 29 years until a month ago where we got the new standards, right? So that is an unfortunate thing. But after that, you did see the Census Bureau step into the process doing what they're supposed to do, which is the statistical agency that collects this information about all people in the United States. And they began the process of research and testing that got us to a place of saying a new minimum reporting category of Middle East and North Africa will improve data collection. So for me, that piece of it has really been about policymaking in some ways working correctly. The battle part of it, and you're correct for sort of pulling that out here, is that we have been a community that has regrettably been erased in some very real and meaningful way. So our governments' national security policies tend to view us as highly, highly visible and targeted. Mm-hmm. We talk about it being a securitized community where the relationship with government is at points quite honestly a difficult tension between striking the right balance between national security and our civil rights and civil liberties. So in that way, we're the canary in a coal mine to the fellow Americans here about the way that our civil liberties are handled. Mm-hmm. So you're rendered super visible in that regard, right? And goodness, we need no better example than seeing Dearborn, Michigan, and the way that the community there is targeted often with events that happen in the world completely unrelated to them.
Yes.
But then invisible in the data. The 1997 standards placed people from Middle East and North Africa exclusively under the white racial category. Yes. And that has meant that for all of these decades, the ability to get information about our community was simply not there. I would, for example, in the 2020 census, I would check other, and I would write in Arab American, or in my case, I'm of Lebanese ethnicity, I would write Lebanese national origin as Arab American ethnicity, I would still be coded as white. Mm-hmm. So even if I declaratively checked other and wrote that down, the back end would code me as white because specifically the current race and ethnicity standards then. So this is a big significant change in terms of saying, we will have this checkbox. We will be able to gather the information about this community, and it will produce better outcomes in people's lives. Yeah. Now, we're not done because there are a variety of concerns, frankly, with the way the standards were issued and other things that have to come up with regards to implementation and preparing for the 2030 decennial. But the idea of not having a checkbox to at least start the process is finally been improved.
Yeah, yeah. Are you surprised by the government's decision? I mean, it has been a long time, and there was nothing that said they had to do it, even at this point. What do you imagine changed that produced this?
Yeah, I'm not at all surprised that we've added the category now and that the revisions of the standards had to take place. I am, frankly, surprised that we didn't get it in time for the 2020 decennial. Huh. The national content test that the Census Bureau did, which has its own issues, which we can choose to talk about or not, but that test was conducted back in 2015, and it demonstrated unequivocally that a new MENA category would improve data collection. And we thought we were in place to have that category added by the 2020 decennial. Hmm. And regretfully, that decennial census for the first time ever was politicized in an unprecedented way. So instead of getting the category in the category of a non-action is an action, without something happening, the Census Bureau simply defaulted to the questions for the 2020 census based on what they asked in 2010. And that was really quite unfortunate. Yeah. And we then had another decennial that continued to reinforce the undercount. So now I will say it's not surprising because this has been the trajectory for some time. What is important to note here is that the Biden administration came to office and with a series of executive orders has really emphasized the importance of data equity.
Yeah.
And because of that, they announced in 2022 that they would be revisiting the race and ethnicity standards. And that process has been going on. They formed an interagency working group. There was a great deal of stakeholder engagement. We were very much part of that process. And then they got to the place of issuing the standards as they did last month. And I think it's important for your listeners to know that in addition to creating this new MENA category, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, which is obviously huge, there were other really important changes. One of them being that for the first time ever, we will have a combined race and ethnicity question.
Yes.
So a respondent will look at one question and say, check all that apply.
Right.
And you include the existing racial categories and then the two MENA and Latino ethnic categories. And I think that's very significant. And the other sort of third bucket of major developments is a new requirement for more detailed data collection.
Yes. Yes.
It's exceptionally important to have disaggregate data about communities because that in some ways that's frankly everything.
It guides policy. I mean, at bottom, right?
It guides policies, and it shows, it'll help us understand disparities that exist within communities.
Yeah.
We know, for example, based on our census analysis of census data, that Arab Americans have higher home ownership rates. Mm-hmm. Arab Americans have higher education levels. There's a lot of indicators that would suggest a fairly successful economic community in that regard. And that's wonderful. That's great. So we have those profiles so we can use them. But at the same time, if you look at that only in its aggregate form, you're going to miss very specific information about perhaps a new immigrant community.
Right.
That's going to take a little bit longer to be able to achieve a level of security and success to do that. We can be looking at the same issue with regards to health research. I mean, the response to the pandemic was a perfect example of the need to make sure that we do better on data collection for all communities.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking about the doors that may have been opened as a result of the new categories that will be added to the U.S. Census for Middle Eastern North African Americans, MENA for short. We're going to be right back with more Created Equal.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Created Equal from 101.9 WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've decided to join. Our guest is Maya Barry. She is the executive director of the Arab American Institute. We're talking about a new set of census categories that will appear in 2030. One in particular, Middle Eastern North African, was a category that Maya's organization has lobbied for a really long time to be added to the U.S. Census. We're talking about what this change will mean. Maya, I want to talk a little about civic and political engagement among MENA communities and what this change means for that. But I want to put it in a pretty time-sensitive context. I think you can't talk about something like this census change, which we don't really have to worry too much about for some time because the census won't happen again for several years. But I think you can't think about all of that without talking about all of the things that are going wrong in our politics right now with regard to members of these communities. If you think about the reaction to what's happening in Israel, to Palestinians in Gaza, if you think about the 4 years that Donald Trump was president and his intentional targeting of people in these communities as somehow less deserving of being Americans than other people, as being a threat to Americanism. If you even think of, as you point out, Dearborn, Michigan, here in our home state, where people have been affected unfairly by what people believe about what's happening overseas. That's all to me a backdrop for what's happening here, and I think it's an important part of trying to figure out how civic and political engagement might change, might get better, I guess, or more effective, or I guess I'm wondering what you think the chances are of that, what will happen.
Yeah. I would answer it in two ways here. And I think that's a really important part of this conversation, because data is about people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
it's all about people. We care about the data collection because at the end of the day, we are a mission-driven advocacy organization that seeks to improve people's lives. So we can have the discussion in the abstract, but you're right. We're coming back to what does it mean for people in terms of their everyday lives. Mm-hmm. So two ways I would think about it. I think more generally, Stephen, the threats to our democracy at this time are very real. Mm-hmm. And you're correct in terms of the way that you've laid out some of the challenges that I think all Americans are experiencing right now. You can talk about issues of reproductive rights. You can talk about book bans targeting Black history and LGBTQ members mm-hmm. of the community. You can talk about right now the incredible, heartbreaking, devastating violence that we are seeing play out in Gaza. One would argue, I'll go ahead and say it, that unfolding level of famine, the number of deaths, that it is a potential, it's being investigated as a potential genocide. So mm-hmm. this is, at the moment this is all occurring, you have people engaged, civic engagement, people weighing in and providing their perspectives on these issues. And it is, I think, challenging when you see your fellow Americans, and you look at polling data, and you look at the way that the primaries have played out thus far, and you see that there is, I think, an overwhelming sense that Americans aren't comfortable with the kind of repression that we're seeing. They oppose these policies, yet we're not seeing necessarily a change in some of those policies. So I think for an organization like ours, where civic engagement is in our DNA.
Yeah.
Our theory of change is literally about come join us in the political process and we can achieve an improved set of civil rights for all, improved equality for all. And I think it is very challenging, if I'm going to be honest about the way things are right now, for us to make that case. I'll continue to make it, and it hasn't changed how we engage in what we do.
Right.
But I do think it's a difficult period on that point.
Yeah.
The second one relates specifically to how this data that is rendered us invisible for decades mm-hmm. is actually used in terms of our civic and political engagement work. So I wish my budget were large enough where I could have a 50 state get out the count program or a 50 state, voter engagement program, but I don't. So how do I make a determination? How do we decide which states we're going to target our work in? The way that we do that is we look at the concentrated sections of our community. Where are we? We look at the census data to determine. You know, California, for example, has more Arab Americans, but Michigan has the highest concentration of Arab Americans in the entire country.
Right.
So as I look at the 12 states of where we are and where we can do our programming, it's based on that data. And when our government is looking at apportionment and how we draw congressional districts, I mean, one of the things I'm most excited about, because I am familiar with Michigan being my home and Dearborn being my home, the way the districts were drawn last time around did not accommodate for accurate data about Arab Americans. So next time around, because the standards have been changed, we will be able to have more accurate data so that the representation of the community is going to be more effective in the state house, in the state legislature, on the congressional federal level. So it's directly related, as you correctly frame the question. These are all things that are interconnected, and having accurate data about these communities is a vehicle to get there.
Yeah. I wonder what you make of the organizing possibility behind this, being seen by the federal government. Will that lead to, I guess, easier identification of the rallying points, I guess, where it matters if you are Middle Eastern or North African?
Yeah, I mean, this is in some ways the challenge, right, for our community is when we talk about asking them to participate in federal data collection, right? There is an underlying issue here, and it's one that we are quite familiar with and have dealt with. Going in the 2020 decennial census, we actually launched a campaign called Yalla Count Me In.
Yes.
And Yalla Count Me In was informed by a lot of focus group work, a lot of polling. We tested our messaging to see, you know, what would work in terms of getting folks to complete their census forms. And the issue of feeling perhaps targeted by government policies, the issue of a community feeling targeted by, you know, someone who gets in a car and says, I'm going to go to Dearborn to target a community and commit a hate crime. Those are very real. And the approach we took was frankly to have deep, deep respect for our community, which is that we would be honest with them and explain what our approach is and how we were approaching it. We all know how the census data was used in a most incredibly difficult and shameful way during World War II with the targeting of the Japanese American community. I think folks may not know the example post 9/11, which was, so we have the major one with Japanese American community. Then we also have a pretty significant data breach that took place after 9/11, mm-hmm. where the Department of Homeland Security was given data by the Census Bureau about Arab American communities. And it's, the famous, notorious, I should say, issue of NYPD profiling of American mm-hmm. Muslims mm-hmm. that took place post 9/11. When you look at those, what were called quote unquote community of interest reports, they cite our demographic data.
Yes.
They cited data from the Arab American Institute to use the areas where they would profile Arab Americans. And that's, you know, that's highly regrettable. But the approach we took was to tell our community that, regrettably, our government has found successful methods of profiling us without a category to accurately count us. But at the same time, we provided assurances that after the violation that took place post 9/11 with DHS, it is illegal for this information to be used this way. It is a $250,000 fine. There are protections in place, but the challenge is, when I say deep respect for our community in terms of how we talk about these issues, the challenge is that the profiling has taken place with readily available public data, and we just haven't had the benefit of understanding the data about our folks with regards to everything else.
Right. But does that make it easier to push back against that profiling? Does it make it easier to rally people around the idea of pushing back?
Absolutely. I think any time that you are able to have accurate data about your community, to build the community's capacity, to build the community's political power, to make sure that a community is being adequately resourced, that its civil rights are being protected, absolutely. And all of that is rooted in accurate data collection. So it is, it's the reason we've been doing this for more than three decades.
Yeah.
It's that important.
Yeah. So I also wonder what you make of the possibility of pretty profound demographic change, at least as far as the census reporting goes as a result of this. As you noted earlier, no matter what you did on the census up until now, you would have been categorized as white because that was one of only two choices, really. You were white or black. Now that there are these combination, I guess, racial and ethnic categories, I mean, I expect that the white population will go down, at least, again, as a reporting mechanism, but that you'd have this new emergence of these other communities. And that seems not just important, but substantively a critical change to the way we think of ourselves as a nation and the way that we think of ourselves as Americans.
Yeah, and I would suggest it's already happened. It's just the federal government, it needs to catch up.
It's not reporting it, right? That's
exactly right, right? It's already happened. In the 2020 decennial census, the second category, the second highest category was some other race.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Some other race is a catch-all category.
That's everybody.
It is not designed, that's right. It's not designed to actually be the place where one lands. But because of the way we were collecting the data, it was so insufficient to reflect the diversity of the American population that you're talking about, that it literally became the second highest category checked. And that's a failure of data collection, mm-hmm. which is why these race and ethnicity standards are so incredibly important. The other point I would make about that is to understand that, as I said, the question stem, the way the question will be asked, it does allow you to check all that apply.
Mm-hmm.
So when I talk to people about this, I really think it's important for them to understand that, because reporters would often be like, this is fascinating. We've never met a community that doesn't want to be white anymore. And I would say, I don't think you're hearing me.
Right.
Not that I'm representing a community that doesn't want to be white anymore. I'm telling you that we're an ethnic community and that is racially diverse, which means we couldn't be exclusively white. And that means there are some members of my community who will continue to check the white racial box.
Uh-huh.
And I would hope, and we're going to work very hard to make sure they also check the MENA checkbox and then write in their ethnicity. But for those members of my community who are Black, they can now check the Black racial box.
Sure.
And also identify their ethnicity. Now, this might be a good time to talk about the problems, because
Actually, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, I do want to talk about the problems, because I want to talk about the road ahead, and I imagine that there are some potholes, I guess we'll call them, on that road ahead. Okay, when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Maya Berry about the changes on the U.S. Census. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. This is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and we're talking with Maya Berry, who is the executive director of the Arab American Institute. We're talking about changes that are coming to the 2030 census that were recently announced. One of them is the addition of a Middle Eastern and North African category that people will be able to choose on the census to identify themselves, identify their ethnicity. Maya, before we broke, you were about to talk about some potential problems that still exist, I guess, not because of the change, but maybe in spite of the change. I think that's a great way to start talking about what the next 6 years will look like as we prepare for the 2030 census, but sort of also beyond that, what remains? What are the things that we should continue thinking about as we try to better identify people and give people better means to locate themselves in the American population?
Yeah, I'll try to reframe, right? Problems and opportunities, but
yes. it's all about perspective, yeah. Right?
as I said in the beginning of our conversation, right? We finally have a glass. This is a major development, but there were some unusual, I would say, ways in which we found ourselves, right? So we were prepared to kind of start shouting from the rooftops, yay, we have the MENA category, and now we're going to shift to our, you know, GOT, the Get Out the Count campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned the Yalla Count Me In became Yalla Count MENA In. We've already launched that website last year, and we're ready to go. But the way that the standards were issued is that the Office of Management and Budget, which is the agency that oversees the race and ethnicity standards, instead of just issuing the standards by saying we will now have a combined race and ethnicity question, we're going to require more detailed data collection, we're going to define some things a little differently, and we were creating this new minimum reporting category. So instead of having 6 initial categories, we now have 7 with the addition of MENA,
mm-hmm.
again, major. They went further, and they actually specifically provided what are called the signaling examples that appear within the check boxes and the write-in samples that actually appear on the form. And those check boxes and write-in examples are a way in which when a respondent gets a form, they're trying to figure out which category do I fit in. It's like when they see it, they say, oh, look, that's me right there. Mm-hmm. I'm Egyptian. I belong there. I'm Palestinian. That makes sense. There it is. That's what I'm going to check off. So typically that's reserved to the Census Bureau. And it's the Census Bureau's research and testing and all the work that goes into that to get us to a place where the way we ask the question, the language that's used and the check boxes and writing examples that are provided to make sure that they produce a more accurate count. Because ultimately, that's it. That's the entire objective here. In this case, unfortunately, we didn't see that. We saw the OMB prescribe specific categories. And regrettably, they don't appear to be reflective of the racial diversity of MENA populations. So in our case, specifically Afro-Arabs are not there. And that's not something that we would find obviously acceptable. We right. didn't go from advocating to not be exclusively white to now say we can't be Black. That doesn't work. Right. With regards to the broader MENA piece of it, one of the largest segments of the MENA communities are Armenians, Armenian Americans, who represent about at least 500,000 within that population. Mm. Based on the current standards, we don't believe Armenians would be would not be included in
oh, wow.
the MENA checkbox. So there are issues there, and it's specifically as we look to next steps here, it's about making sure that the way that the standards were issued, which includes, by the way, the formation of a new interagency working group on the implementation of the race and ethnicity standards. It includes additional research and testing. It includes more community engagement, more engagement with stakeholders. I'm so proud of the fact that the campaign that went into all of this produced more than 20,000 comments last year.
Wow.
When they put the Federal Register notice out to say, this is what we're considering for race and ethnicity standards, what do folks think? And more than 20,000 comments were received, and the great, great majority were all supportive. So for our perspective, there is more work to be done, and it's going to happen by continuing to engage in the process that we have. And I'll say that the standards, they give federal agencies up to 5 years to comply with the standards.
Right.
But each of those agencies has 18 months to submit their action plans for how they're going to revise the standards and comply with the new standards. And we think that all of these are touch points for us to be able to more effectively demonstrate why, as much as this was an incredibly important development, we still have to get it right.
Yeah.
And then the only thing I would also add to this, by the way, mm-hmm. is that it's not only were the MENA examples not great, neither were the examples under Latino, Hispanic and Latino, where right. Afro-Latinos are also not represented within that checkbox. And again, that's just something that's going to continue to produce an undercount, and we've just got to do better.
You know, in some ways, it seems as though, we've had a conversation with Maria Hinojosa of Latino USA about the changes for Latinos on the next census. And she said something similar to mm-hmm. what you just said. It seems to me that a lot of this goes back to the difficulty or confusion that I think still springs out of the very crude and discriminatory way that the census was pulled together in the first place, right? There are these oversimplifications that were arrived at because of the reach of segregation and discrimination in the society at the time. That's really hard to untangle and make sense of, 200 and almost 50 years later. That the nation looks really different, and it's super complicated how it's different. But the census is maybe too crude a tool right now, at least, to reflect that accurately.
I mean, my perspective on that is that we've made tremendous progress mm-hmm. in how the decennial is conducted. This is not the same thing as 1970.
Right.
And I have, you know, one piece of paper that has 10 questions on it. The majority, you know, of us are completing almost all of this work online. There is no longer this issue of exclusive concern about real estate on a federal form
mm-hmm.
because we have the ability to do better in this regard. So I think that has to come into play here. And to your point about what I'm hearing from you, this idea is that, like, we know who we are.
Yes, right.
We know who we are. We know how we identify. We're not looking for a federal form to give us our identity. We're simply saying you have to do better, federal government, at collecting that accurate data about these communities across the board. I mean, everywhere, in order for our system to operate better, in order for all our rights to be protected. And I have to believe that the rigid thinking that might have said, I can only code you this way,
mm-hmm.
or one subgroup example can appear only under this category, but it can't appear in two different categories, is frankly outdated and not reflective of where the American population is now.
Yeah.
So it's not, I simply will not accept that you can't put Sudanese under MENA
right.
to capture Sudanese who may identify as ethnically Arab, or Dominicans under Hispanic and Latino who are racially Black but identify ethnically as Latino. Like it's on some level just mind-boggling to think that we can't get that right. So I know we can, and I think the key here is to properly resource the Census Bureau to make sure that the Bureau has the subject area experts on these regions so that, like, for example, we need to make sure that there is a MENA subject area expert at the Census Bureau
right.
who is going to be part of implementing a brand new category. That's critical. And more research and more testing and determining the best ways to get there is I think, the way that the policy process must work. And it does, it really does make the case, though, for the stakeholder engagement. Because unfortunately, I don't think this happens on its own.
Yeah. I mean, that seems to put a lot at stake in this year, in 2024, as, you know, we all go to the polls to, you know, select a new president or maybe keep the old one, select a new Congress or maybe keep much of the old one. These are political questions in many ways. And the politicization of the census doesn't necessarily go away, I guess, just because this one change has been affected.
No, unfortunately, it doesn't. But we are doing everything that we can. And by the we here, it's broader than just Arab Americans and those folks who are working on the MENA category. It's the broader civil rights community. It's mm-hmm. The data nerds who have worked so hard to improve these race and ethnicity standards so that we can have better data collection. And it really is to make sure that we depoliticize this process.
Yeah.
People talk about the Biden administration did this. It's like, actually, the Office of Management and Budget and the interagency working group that had the representatives from every single federal agency, career statisticians, purple mm-hmm. people that have been working on these issues for a long time. They're the ones who got us to the point of these recommending these standards and OMB adopting them. And the Census Bureau, with incredibly hardworking civil service folks who've been there for decades doing this work. They do not have a political dog in this fight, so to speak, right? They are here just to collect more accurate data. And the more that we can keep it outside of the political space,
sure.
whether it's members of Congress who are holding hearings about questions that have never been tested, who we know would suppress the count, to agencies that are issuing reports about if there's a different president elected, then we will do this. I mean, this is about data collection and,
right.
and not the politics of any of these other issues.
Yeah. Okay. Maya Barry, it was really delightful to have your voice with us to have this conversation. Thanks so much for joining us on Created Equal.
I'm so happy to have been with you. And thank you so much for covering such an incredibly important topic.
So, Carrie, I feel like one of the things that we learned from both the conversation with Maria Hinojosa and just now with Maya Berry is that the government is way behind in adapting to the way that the population here has changed over a really long period of time, and that this effort to catch up, you know, they're welcoming it in some way, but they're also frustrated, I think, because it's not going fast enough.
You know, I'm also curious to know, like, when we're in those subsects of those racial categories, once we break them down, and you've talked about it in the episode, how does that mobilize these groups more often?
That's
we saw
right.
the uncommitted vote here in Michigan. What does that do when folks know, okay, we have these populations of folks that we similarly identify with who have maybe culturally political issues that we will rally around?
Right.
How does that change our political landscape?
Yeah. Well, it's really a question of organizing and who does the organizing and how responsive the communities are to the idea of organizing around this new tool that they haven't had before.
And Maya seemed like it was going to be pretty useful.
She seemed very optimistic about it, for sure.
Yeah. Right.
That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.